Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and today's conversation is with Dr. Anthony Fauci, Director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Also joining us today from IBM is Tom Romeo. Dr. Fauci, to give our listeners a better understanding of the work of NIAID, could you give us a brief overview of the fundamentals of vaccinology? First, what exactly is a virus, and how would you define pathogenesis? And then second, what is classical vaccinology and the relationship between discovery and development within this model or paradigm?
Well, first of all, let's start off with the definition of a virus. There are virus and bacteria and parasites. Viruses are one of the pathogens, as it were, which is in a virus. It's not a free-living microbe because it requires another cell for it to survive and replicate, but it's made up of either DNA or RNA. There are RNA viruses and there are DNA viruses. And what it has is the ability to co-opt functions of a cell to replicate itself. And by doing that, it generally causes disease. An example of influenza virus replicates, it binds to the surface of respiratory cells, enters the cells, replicates, causes inflammation and damage to the epithelium, and that's why you wind up coughing and sometimes getting serious pneumonias. Polio does the same thing with the nervous system. HIV/AIDS does the same thing with the immune system. So they attack different tissues of the body, but they cannot live outside of cells. There are many viruses for which we have developed successful vaccines. The fundamental principle of vaccinology is to expose a person to a weakened or killed form of a microbe. In this case, let's call it a virus, such as polio or measles, so that the body can mount an immune response so that when you actually get exposed to the real microbe or virus, that you will then have already a big head start on mounting an immune response that could protect you against disease. The principles of vaccinology are based on the concept that the body has the capability of responding adequately to a particular virus in question. So even though people get sick with polio, some get paralyzed, people get sick with measles and smallpox, some of these people die, at the end of the day, most of the people mount an immune response that clears the virus from the body and leaves you with long-lasting protective immunity against subsequent challenge. So the whole philosophy and the strategy of vaccinology is to expose the person in a harmless way to either a part of or a killed virus that doesn't harm them, but that mounts an immune response that ultimately allows that person to protect themselves when they get exposed.
Interesting. So as a follow-up, what are the characteristics of a viral infection for which there are vaccines?
Well, a characteristic for a viral infection for which there are vaccines is just what I said, the ability to mount in the body an immune response that ultimately controls the virus. We have a problem with, for example, with HIV/AIDS, because HIV does not seem to mount in the body an immune response that's ultimately able to clear it and hence develop protective immunity. We have no idea at this point why that's the case. So when we develop, or if we develop a vaccine for HIV, we're going to have to do better than what natural infection does. Usually vaccinologists like myself and my colleagues, we copy what natural infection does. We say, well, natural infection induces this type of immune response. Let's design a vaccine that mimics natural infection and induces this type of an immune response. But with HIV/AIDS, the immune response that natural infection induces is not very protective at all. So we have to do better than natural infection.
So as a follow-up to that, can you tell us a little bit more about the next generation of HIV/AIDS treatments and antiviral drugs? And how is HIV vaccinology a significant departure from classical vaccinology?
Well, first of all, starting with therapy, we have a number now, 30 FDA-approved antivirals for HIV. So if there's ever been any real successes in infectious diseases, the development of adequate, if not very good, antivirals against HIV is really a true success story. You develop an antiviral by getting a compound that's directed against a vulnerable point in the replication cycle of the virus. So, for example, we have reverse transcriptase inhibitors, which block a very important enzyme, reverse transcriptase, that the virus uses to replicate itself. Once it changes itself from RNA to DNA, it inserts itself into the chromosome of the cell. It uses an enzyme called integrase. So one of the drugs that we've developed is an integrase inhibitor. When it tries to replicate itself and leave the cell, namely butt off the cell the way viruses do, go to the surface, butt off, and then infect another cell, it requires an enzyme called protease. So we've developed protease inhibitors. So there, what you do is you look at the vulnerable part in the replication cycle and you develop a drug against it. And as I mentioned, this has been very successful in the arena of HIV. Not so successful has been the efforts in developing a vaccine. And you asked the question about classical vaccinology. Classical vaccinology is what I was describing just a moment ago. And that is, you look at what the virus does in its natural infection and you mimic it because that's what you want to do with a vaccine. That's the classical approach. We can't take the classical approach with HIV because natural infection doesn't do a very good job of inducing this type of protection. So we've got to develop a vaccine that when the body sees it, it does much better at mounting an immune response than when it sees the natural infection. So we have a very ominous task of having to do better than what natural infection does. That's not going to be easy. I think it's possible, but it's not going to be very easy.
Earlier, you mentioned tuberculosis, and this is certainly a very old disease. However, it remains one of the major causes of disability and death throughout the world. In fact, today, I believe almost one-third of the world's population is thought to be infected. Could you elaborate on advances in TB research? Specifically, what studies are underway to determine the optimal strategies for the prevention, treatment, and diagnosis of TB? And what are some of the barriers to vaccine development for TB?
Well, TB is a very interesting disease because, as you mentioned, it's an ancient disease. It's been around literally forever as far as history goes. The impact of morbidity and mortality today in our modern age of technology, of vaccines and therapeutics and diagnostics, in some respects is almost an embarrassment. As you mentioned, one-third of the world's population is infected with latent TB. They're not sick, but they're infected. However, there are 9 million new cases each year, and there are 1.7 million deaths each year from tuberculosis. Yet, our diagnostics are antiquated. They've been around for decades and decades, if not more than a century. The vaccine against tuberculosis doesn't work very well against adult TB. It works reasonably well against childhood non-pulmonary TB. And the therapeutics, we haven't had a brand new therapeutic for tuberculosis in over four decades. We've got to bring tuberculosis into the 21st century with regard to research opportunities. We've been victims of our own success because we've developed many, many years ago a skin test that can diagnose it, therapies that can cure it, and you can control it. We were victims of our own success because we were so successful, we neglected the research agenda for TB. And now the major advances of the latter part of the 20th and the first part of the 21st century have passed by tuberculosis. So it is really important for us right now to use the research advances, the molecular approaches for diagnosis, for the development of drugs as well as vaccines to try and bring TB, the control of TB, into 21st century technology.
So could this number of one-third be actually understated and more people could be walking around with it?
Rather than more people walking around with, we need to figure out how we can prevent the people who ultimately develop active TB. Of those 2.2 billion people who are walking around with latent TB, there's a 10% chance in their lifetime that they will develop active TB. And if they have an immunodeficiency disease like HIV, there's a 10% per year chance that they will develop active TB. So if you have HIV and latent TB, the chances are overwhelming, if you're not treated, that you're going to wind up with active TB sometime in your lifetime. So we have a long way to go to control TB. And now we have an additional problem of multiple and extensively drug-resistant TB, which means that the old drugs that have been historically so successful in treating TB are no longer successful in a certain proportion of TB cases that are resistant to the drugs. So we have got to develop a better pipeline of new drugs to replace the drugs for which the TB is now resistant to.
Interesting. So switching gears a bit, each year here in the U.S., influenza kills more than 36,000 people and hospitalizes another 200,000. On a worldwide basis, the annual epidemics cause about 250 to half a million deaths each year. Tell us about your progress in influenza research programs, particularly in the area of pandemic influenza preparedness.
Well, that's an interesting point because we have been, I believe, as a society, somewhat complacent about the morbidity and mortality of seasonal flu. We get very excited when there appears to be a threat of a pandemic flu. We were concerned since 2005 about the H5N1 bird flu, which killed a lot of birds but rarely jumped species to infect humans, 400 or 500 people, and half of them died with a very high mortality. But that's a relatively few number of people. Now, in the fall of this year, we had a regular flu season, but as the flu season ended in March and April of 2009, we started to see cases of a brand new, quote, swine flu, which is an H1N1, first appearing in Mexico and then spreading throughout the United States and globally. Now, that has real pandemic potential because it can spread very easily from person to person. So we're watching that very closely, and part of our pandemic influenza preparedness is to develop the infrastructure to develop vaccines as rapidly as we can, to develop new pipeline of drugs to treat influenza. So there is really a connection between how well you have prepared for seasonal flu and your capability of surging up for pandemic flu. So we're right now in the process of implementing a pandemic influenza plan that was established in 2005 in response to the threat from the H5N1 bird flu, only we didn't realize it wouldn't be the bird flu that was going to be the problem. The problem was going to be an H1N1 flu that has swine influenza genes.
Sure, sure. So can you expand on this point a little bit more? So how does what happens this summer in locations, say, below the equator, inform our potential response during the upcoming flu season?
Well, we know that H1N1 is here, and it established itself in the United States and globally outside of the flu season. Luckily, it was not particularly severe. It was about as severe as a seasonal flu. The problem is it was happening out of season. Right. We were seeing illnesses, particularly among young people, in April, May, and June and beyond. So that's something that is very unusual for seasonal flu. Now, the reason we don't see as much spread now in the spring and summer of 2009 is that flu does not spread as well in the summer of a given region of the world for a number of reasons. The flu doesn't do well when there's open spaces, warm weather, and high humidity. When there's close spaces, cold weather, and low humidity, flu seems to spread better. However, in the summer, here in the northern hemisphere, is the winter in the southern hemisphere. So as we get into the summer of 2009, that is really the winter in places like Australia, South Africa, Argentina, and Chile. So we're going to be watching very closely what happens during a real flu season to regions of the world that we know there is going to be H1N1 swine flu. What happens there is generally predictive of what will happen here in the United States in the fall and the winter at 2009 and as we go into 2010.
Interesting. So all eyes will be watching what happens.
Indeed. Okay. Indeed.
What is NIAID's role in combating bioterrorism? We will ask Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, to share with us when the conversation about healthcare continues on the Business of Government Hour.